a slight difference in the NIV, and I'll touch on some of that as we go through. This is a Psalm of David, and it is a lament. He begins, "How long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? All the day. How long shall my enemy be exalted over me? Consider and answer me, O Lord my God. Light up my eyes, lest I sleep the sleep of death, lest my enemy say, I have prevailed over him, lest my foes rejoice because I am shaken. But I have trusted in your steadfast love. My heart shall rejoice in your salvation. I will sing to the Lord because he's dealt bountifully with me." Now, I want you to imagine that this was a song and that David was a contemporary writer, and he's bringing it to a record label. Okay, so he goes to record label number one, and he gives it to the agent or to the owner, and the owner looks at it and he goes, "You know, doubt doesn't sell. Okay? You need to take stanzas 5 and 6, the good stuff, and just really expand on them and tie them up with a nice pretty bow. That is what sells here today." So David, feeling dejected, takes his psalm, his song, and goes to record label number two and puts the song before the guy at record label number two. And record label number two says, "Look, people don't like to resolve things these days. People like to live in the angsty struggle of stanzas 1 and 2. So throw in some distortion while you're at it and never resolve anything, and you've got a killer new song." I think that really highlights the fact that David's song and David's psalm today probably doesn't play well. Psalm 13 doesn't play well for a couple of reasons. And I think it's because we have the tendency, A, to hide our struggle, our heart struggle, by putting on a perfect mask. So we want to tie up things in a nice pretty bow and hang out in stanzas 5 and 6. Or we are not okay, and we are refusing to budge from that position. We want to live in the struggle and not move on. Now, you see all kinds of churches and all kinds of groups of people, even within the church, who camp out in one of those two positions. Let's wallow in our defeat. Let's pretend like we never struggle. David's psalm speaks a lot to us, I think, as men, because he neither hides the struggle of his heart, nor does he camp out in his struggle and refuse to budge. He shows us something of what it's like to start out at a very, very bad place and move from that place of pouting into a place of praise. We see David literally moving through three stages here in this psalm. And I want to go through and point those out. First, in verses 1 and 2, he pouts. Let's read those. "How long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long must I take counsel in my soul and have sorrow in my heart all the day? How long shall my enemy be exalted over me?" There's four how longs there. And it's clear that the how longs of verse 1 that are directed at God are because of the how longs of verse 2. In verse 2, David tells us something about his condition. The NIV renders this, "How long must I take counsel in my soul," or "How long must I wrestle with my thoughts," is what the NIV says. There's a real anguish of spirit on David's part here. And it is either producing sorrow in him, or it's the result of the sorrow within him. So either the depression or the wrestling that's going on in David's soul is the result of his situation, or the depression and the wrestling of the soul is the thing that David's dealing with. We aren't quite sure. But we know that he's experiencing something of an emotional turmoil. But he's also experiencing enemies having the upper hand. And now we assume that these are literal enemies, being other nations or people who are conspiring against him. But they could easily be those things that are enemies of our souls, our flesh, Satan's opposition, or just the situation of the fallen world that we live in. So whatever David is experiencing here, it is driving him to make assumptions And those assumptions are actually accusations that he's leveling at God. When he says in verse 1, "How long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me?" He is essentially accusing God of two things. He's accusing God of ignoring him and avoiding him. He's accusing God of being distant and not caring. And we know that's not true. All of you know that's not true. And let me tell you something that you already know. David knows it isn't true. But this isn't Bible trivia. This is soul wrestling. This is what I refer to when I used to teach college students, because they deal with it probably more in their generation than we do, but we still deal with it, as emotional theology, or a theology of emotion. And what I mean by that is here. When we experience life, and there's a dissonance between our experience of life and what we believe faithful living should be, our emotions tend to craft a picture of what we think God truly is, or who we think God truly is. And if we trust an emotion alone, it really clouds a true, accurate understanding of who God is. And we live and view things through that lens. Now, for a generation who combated that with a word, that's one thing. For a generation that tends not to do that, that's a completely different situation. But we're all, if we see David's life here, we are all, even the man after God's own heart, we are all capable of viewing God through the lens of our own experience. Catch 22 is, though, even though the theology of emotion is bad, the catch 22 is this: if I never utter that bad emotional theology before the Lord, how am I ever going to truly process it, identify it, and deal with it? How many of you would grow angry at your child if they came to, or you dropped them off, say, when, if you remember when they were little, if you've had little kids, you dropped them off somewhere, maybe a grandparent's house, maybe left them with a babysitter, and they asked the question, "Are you ever coming back?" Because they're too little to understand the fact that it's not like they're doubting your character or anything. There's this sense of fear within them as a child that you're going to leave and you're not going to come back. Now, would you get angry with your child at that moment? Absolutely not. You would comfort them and reassure them, "I'm always going to come back and get you." David is not being disrespectful here. He's being a fearful child. And he's uttering those fears and laying those fears before God, which is what he really should do with them, instead of hiding them, pushing them down, and pretending that they don't exist. Because the more he pretends they don't exist, the more they're going to subtly and secretly affect and infect his view of God. So he doesn't do that. He shows us that we must lay our wrong thinking before the Lord so it doesn't grow insidiously like a cancer in our walk with the Lord. After all, the Lord sees what's in our heart anyway. He knows what David's thinking. He knows what David's feeling. It's not like David can actually hide what he's truly feeling about God from God. And David knows that as well. Just recently, in a small group of mine, one of the members of our small group, it's about 18 months ago, he decided to move from a small level of business to owning a piece of property and building a building. He sought advice from the guys in the group. He sought advice from people outside the group. He wanted to honor God in this. He really was concerned that he was listening to the Lord and not his own desire. And he went through that process. And then the rain hits. The building's gone up. The building's almost complete. But every single time they try to pave the parking lot, it rains. If you don't remember the rainy season we just went through, it was unbelievable. And it rained, and it rained, and it rained, and they'd clear it out. He'd pay more money for them to bring in fresh dirt. It would rain again. And he finally came to our group one morning, extremely frustrated. And he says, "Guys, I'm going to have to be honest with you this morning. I'm really mad at God." And he felt very guilty about saying that out loud. And he said, "I don't understand. I laid this before God. I sought God on this. I don't know what he's doing. I can't understand what's happening." And we took a moment and we said, he's like, "I don't get what God's doing." And I said, "You might not ever get what God's doing on this side of heaven." That's the thing about God. God's so big that sometimes his plans for us don't make sense till many years down the line. How many of you have ever experienced that? You've gone through something, you go, "I don't get it. If I were to write the story, this is not the way I'd write it." And then a few chapters later, or a dozen chapters later, you get why in chapter 2 or 3 of your life, this particular thing happened. But Paul even says to us, at some points, none of the chapters may resolve that for us. What might resolve that for us is being face to face to God, because his ways are higher than our ways and his understanding is higher than our understanding. Until we are glorified and standing before him and he explains to us the whys, we might not ever get it on this side of heaven. My hope for my friend is that he will. And he came to some resolution and he came to a point of understanding that day. But it just describes the wrestling that we've all had. I've had those moments too, where I've not understood why I'm facing the things I'm facing in my life. So we so often want God to get us through the situation that we fail to realize that maybe it's not what God's bringing us to, but what he's bringing us through that is what he wants to do in our life. Because it's the struggle, it's the wrestle that makes us stronger. And that's one of the things we said to him, "Look, this might not be about your building, your business, or your parking lot. This might be about the next level of not understanding what God is doing that he's going to bring into your life." We don't know. We don't know what God is doing. Absent him of saying it directly, we don't understand. But we do know his character. And we also know we're not meant to stay in that struggle. We're not meant to wallow in that struggle. We're supposed to look at it head on, lay it out before God, and truly process it in light of who he is. And that's what David does. In verses 3 and 4, he moves from pouting into praying. Look what he says. "Consider and answer me, O Lord my God. Light up my eyes, lest I sleep the sleep of death. Lest my enemy say, I have prevailed over him. Lest my foes rejoice because I am shaken." Notice that instead of blaming God for his fears, he's moved to naming those fears before God. He's moved on from the 4 how longs to the 3 lests that describe the fears that what he fears is going to happen. And what he fears is going to happen is, first, he fears death. Second, he fears that the enemy will somehow think that by his death they have power they don't truly possess. Not just over him, but over God himself. Because this is a battle of gods back in that day. And third, he fears that even if he doesn't die, that the enemy will rejoice that he has been spiritually demoralized. And as the king of Israel, David is aware that this would truly detract from God's glory. To avoid these things, David asks that God light up his eyes. Now, what does that mean? Well, 2 things. First of all, it's a sense of a restored sense of joy. Joy, as most of us know, is not circumstantial. If you equate joy and happiness, those are bad synonyms. Joy is truly and wholly trusting and having this deep sense of fulfillment, knowing that God is going to bring to good whatever the situation you are in the midst of. That's why Paul can write Philippians from a prison and speak about joy, because he knows the eternal joy that is coming. And that filters into and trickles down to the moment, the temporal moment that he's experiencing. And so what David is praying for is that light that shines in his soul, that joy, that's something that David can't muster up, and he knows he can't muster it up. That's why he's praying for it. Do we know that? If we know it, do we act like we know it? Joy is not something that you can muster up, because joy is one of the fruit of the Spirit. Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control are not things that the Christian believer can just will themselves into. I can't look in the mirror and say, this morning you're going to be joyful. That's not in my power. What is in my power is to go to my knees and ask the Lord to give me joy. And that is exactly what David does here. He shows us that the root of joy is not in himself sitting there. He's not going, okay, God, today I'm going to be joyful. He's not naming it and claiming it. He's going to God and asking for it, because he knows the character of his Father is to give good gifts. And he's beseeching the Spirit to bring that joy. And joy itself is a testimony to the reality of God. And he desperately wants his enemies to see that reality of the strength of God in him. But that phrase also is this: that light in the eyes is an illumination by the Spirit. It doesn't just connote joy. It connotes enlightenment. The Spirit, he's wanting the Spirit to open his eyes to see what God sees and see how God sees things, to give him a perspective on what he's dealing with, whatever he's dealing with, and we don't know what he's dealing with. But he wants God to give him an enlightenment into his situation. And you see, what David prays here, interestingly enough, isn't what necessarily I would pray in the same situation. I'd pray, zap my enemies, O Lord. Because he's already named that as his fear. Now, in other places, he does pray against his enemies, but not here. Here, he prays for the light of his eyes, an understanding, to understand why God's bringing the enemies to bear on him. Why is he allowing it if God is sovereign? He's asking God to give him eyes to see things as God sees things, and ultimately, he does see things that way. Because in verses 5 and 6, he moves to the third stage, which is he praises. So he's pouted, he's prayed, and now he praises. Isn't that nice? Nice three P's there, three alliterated P's for you. He says in verses 5 and 6, "But I have trusted in your steadfast love. My heart shall rejoice in your salvation. I will sing to the Lord because he has dealt bountifully with me." For David, the resolution comes at the end of the psalm, sort of like those 70s and 80s sitcoms where, you know, the problem begins the first 5 to 10 minutes, and then by the end of the sitcom, everything's resolved. Well, we're not to believe that this kind of resolution happens over the courses of 6 stanzas in the matter of what you could probably say this psalm in about a minute or less. This psalm reflects something that David's already probably struggled through. It could take days, it could take weeks, it could take years. The point is, we don't stay in that spot. We're constantly moving forward and trying to understand. But ultimately, God brings it to resolution. For David, there are 2 things that God opens his eyes to see, which cause him to praise. First is his personal history with God. In verse 6, he says, "I will sing to the Lord." Why? Because he has dealt bountifully with me. In the NIV, it says, "The Lord has been good to me." And there are a lot of ways to recount how God has been good to David as he reflected on his personal history. God called him from the pasture to be the king over Israel. God defeated Goliath through David. God protected David from King Saul, and God forgave David's deepest sins. And this is the guy who broke every single commandment while he was keeping hidden his betrayal and murder of Uriah and his adultery with Bathsheba. And yet he experienced the forgiveness that came from God, which is also a sign to David that God's been good to him. It becomes a spiritual exercise for us because when we're in the moment, we've gone through many of you have gone through some significant spiritual deliverance in the sense that you were going through something that God answered the prayer and you're like, wow, that's amazing. But then you get into the next situation and all that stuff just sort of evaporates and you forget about it or go, okay, so that's what God did back then, but he's not going to do that again. It's like when the Israelites were delivered from the greatest army on the face of the earth. They go into the wilderness. They saw Pharaoh and his army wiped out by God. They get into the wilderness. They're starving, and they start complaining that God has brought them in the desert to die. And oftentimes, we can feel like God's delivered us only to bring us to destruction. But that's not true. God was very angry about the fact that they felt that because he had gone through great pains to deliver them in a very magnificent way. But we too can get to that point of feeling that God really isn't interested in delivering us, which is why it's important to trace back how he's done this before. If you read the Psalms, if you read the Old Testament, so many times they rehearse what God has done for the people of Israel over and over again, from the deliverance from captivity into the conquest of the promised land. And they rehearse the ways that God has been good to them. And David can see what he sees now because he can see that God has been good to him, even if he's not experiencing in that moment what he senses to be God's goodness. But second, he sees God's covenant history, and that causes him to rejoice. Where do I get that? Verse 5, when David says, "But I have trusted in your steadfast love," the term steadfast love in Hebrew there that he uses is God's covenant love for his people. In verse 6, David uses the term Lord. Whenever you see, if you didn't know this already, you probably all knew this, capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D in your English Bible. It is a transliteration of Yahweh or Jehovah. It's the covenant name of God. It's the name that God gave to Moses when Moses said, "Who should I say sent me?" And he says, "Tell them I am sent you. I am that I am," or "I will be what I will be," is what that word means. And what God is saying is that he's highlighting his faithfulness and steadfast love. That's who he is. That's his character. That's how he identifies himself. And it isn't just a personal thing. It's a corporate thing. It's baked into covenant terminology, is the idea that God's promise and salvation to Noah, God's choosing of Abraham and his promise to bless the nations through him, God's calling Moses to deliver the Israelites from slavery and to teach them about God and to lead them into the promised land, or lead them to the promised land. And God's personal goodness to David intersects with this covenant goodness when he promises to David that David would never fail to have a king sit on the throne of Israel. Which brings us to King Jesus in the new covenant and his blood, which is a benefit to us. And when we consider these things that seem so true about God in the darkness of our soul, we can't help but see that darkness melt into joy for what God has done for his people and what God has done for us. Now, I'm not saying this morning that you walked into these doors and suddenly after prayer, you're going to be led to praising. That might be true. But I can say this. Because God is a covenant-keeping God, and it's a very one-sided thing. If you read the Old Testament, one guy asked me, he goes, "Well, the Old Testament just seems hopeless." I'm like, exactly. You're supposed to get to the end of the Old Testament and go, "Man, we need a Savior." None of these guys, from judges to prophets to kings, really cut it. You need something else. You need God himself to come down. But the point being that in the midst of our struggle this morning, whatever we're dealing with, we need to be honest and lay that before the Lord. Now, if you don't trust the guys around your table, if you don't know them well enough, that's fine. But there should be some people in your life that you trust well enough to lay that before them. You should definitely be laying it before God. There are some things in your life that you haven't really been honest with God about. And you really want to actually process and not hide and brush under the carpet. Today's the day. Whether that's here or whether that's when you leave and you're driving in the car and you have and I love the comfort of my car. People think I'm just yelling at traffic when I'm just kind of voicing prayers. Or I'm insane and I'm talking to myself, or I'm talking on a Bluetooth or whatever. I can really truly process something before God. And I have had many moments like that. And I'll tell you one moment before we end. But it's a point of getting to that point of being honest and processing that before God and not leaving it, not stewing on it, but then getting past the pouting to prayer and ultimate realization of the true character of God is not the accusations we've leveled against him. He is a good God. And whatever he's doing now, he's going to bring deliverance. I remember, and as pastors, you know, we like to talk about how this has been impacted us in the past because we want to look like we're actually doing really, really well now. I still have my moments, guys. But one of the most profound realities of this happened when I was in college. One morning, for whatever reason, I had sensed that the Lord had called me to ministry, and then I felt a really deep frustration with that I wasn't good enough. And then the 30-minute ride in from my home to college campus, I had a very honest conversation with God in which I got extremely emotional, probably a little loud. And I said, all right, well, if you want me, here I am. Come get me. If you want me to serve you, I don't see what is necessary to be a minister at this point, because I was just having a really, really bad season. And I said, if you want me, here I am, come get me. Those were my words. I drove in to the Baptist Student Union. That was back when it was called the Baptist Student Union. It was not BCM as it is now. I walk in the door. It's early, early morning. Nobody's in there. And there's almost this really profound holy moment where the Lord prompted me to look on. There's a message pole that we had where we'd stick messages to each other on this pole. I walked in, and something told me to look at the pole. I looked at the pole. There was one note. And in my spirit, I heard, not audibly, the greatest inclination that is for you. And I said, being the constant skeptic that I am, that's not true. I walked up to it. It was for me. It was an anonymous note from somebody telling me how much I'd ministered to them. Now, don't say that to bolster me, because I felt like I wasn't good enough. But when I laid before God my fear that I wasn't good enough, which I wasn't good enough, I mean, God's like, you can't be. I have to do it through you. He reminded me that he hears me, and he was going to answer. And when I said, here I am, come get me, he did. And I just kind of wonder what would have happened if I kept that all inside and would I have ever dealt with those feelings of inadequacy as I was facing ministry. I don't know what you're dealing with this morning, and I don't know what you're wrestling with this morning, But I urge you to have that conversation, not just with the guys at your table, but with God this morning, and lay it all out there so he can extract the poison and he can replace the false accusations with the truth of his character. Let's take some time around the tables to pray this morning.